You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday the 31st of May 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, we have a bit of a cautionary tale for you today. We're going to look at what happened with Usman Khan. Usman Khan was the Islamic terrorist that stabbed to death a male and female that were trying to rehabilitate him on London Bridge. And you will remember that some rather plucky have-a-go heroes from the public managed to bring the guy down. And one of the members of the public was a reformed criminal. I believe he was a murderer. And there were a couple of others as well. And they used a narwhal tusk to actually bring the guy down. But the fact is, he should never have been allowed out like that. He should never have been allowed out from prison. It was quite clear that he still presented a threat to the general public. And we've had an inquiry on this over the last couple of weeks. And a lot of information has come out at this inquiry. And it really should have been avoided, and those two people should still be alive. So we'll have a look at how this all began. When Usman Khan was convicted for being part of a plot to bomb the London Stock Exchange, the judge was under no illusion about the serious danger that he posed to society. Mr. Justice Wilkie singled him out from other extremists on trial because he was clearly a devious and scheming man dedicated to his extremist ideology. The judge said that even after serving a lengthy custodial sentence, Khan would continue to pose a significant risk to the public because he was working towards a more ambitious and more serious jihadist agenda. So how did it happen then? How did this guy manage to get out? How did he manage to con the rehabilitation services into believing that he had turned his back on extremist Islam? Well, it's this liberal belief that extremist Islam is a false version of Islam and real Islam is the liberal version that we have in Britain. But the liberal Islam that we have in Britain, that doesn't exist in the center of Islam, does it? It doesn't exist in Saudi Arabia. What do they have in Saudi Arabia? Well, they still have floggings, they still have hangings, they still have marriages of nine-year-old girls. A lot of the things that we would suggest are part of extremist Islam are in actual fact just a part of normal Saudi Arabian Islam. And Khan was a proponent of Sharia law and sticking to fundamentalist Islam, basically. He would have been quite happy in Saudi Arabia. It's this idea that we have a liberal Islam and that's the real Islam. That's the false idea. That only exists in Britain and in the West, this idea that there is another form of Islam if only we can just talk these extremist Muslims into following it, they will follow it. And this is an example of what happens when you fall for that idea, when you fall for that propaganda, which goes against everything that we have seen through history. History tells us that Islam has been trying to conquer the West for all these years. And over the last 20 years, we have seen violent attacks taking place within Europe, and these violent attacks take place because we have large settlements of Muslims in those countries. Countries which don't have a large number of Muslims in them don't suffer from the terrorist attacks. The countries with the most Muslims have the most terrorist attacks. The most terrorist attacks occur in France, and France has more Muslims in it than anywhere else in Europe. Rejecting Khan's hollow claims of repentance, which came in the form of a personal letter, the judge ordered him to serve an indeterminate sentence for public protection in 2012. So they knew in 2012 that he wasn't being serious about repenting of his terrorist ideas. This technically limitless jail term meant that he would be released only if and when a parole board was convinced that he no longer posed a threat. Mr. Justice Wilkie concluded that the public could not be adequately protected if Khan was allowed to serve part of his sentence on license in the community, and his warning was grimly prophetic. 6 years later, Khan was released from a maximum security prison on license. After pretending that he had rejected Islamic extremism, the 28-year-old quickly became the poster boy for the prison rehabilitation system. And that's absolutely incredible. He was actually used in the posters that the rehabilitation group actually used. They were very proud of this man. They thought that they had succeeded in doing the unachievable, and they had actually managed to turn an Islamic extremist into a liberal. And I guess there are some instances of that sort of thing happening. There's a guy called Mo Hamza or something like that, I think his name is, and he turns up on RT now, and he used to be an extremist Muslim. But the suspicion is that he was always working for MI5 in the first place, before he had this road to Damascus moment and turned his back on extremism. I think he's something to do with the Quillian Foundation. But I don't think he was ever actually charged with trying to carry out anything like this Khan was. I mean, he was actually found guilty of preparing terrorist acts. So he was willing to put his ideas into action. So the idea that he would then turn over a new leaf and realize that what he was doing is wrong, the only way he could really do that is if he stopped being a Muslim. And quite clearly, he hadn't stopped being a Muslim. Astonishingly, he was given permission by the probation service and the police to travel from his bedsit in Stafford to a prisoner rehabilitation conference at Fishmongers Hall on November the 29th, 2019. And he really should never have been allowed out of prison in the first place, let alone them pointing out that it was wrong that he was allowed to travel to a prisoner rehabilitation conference from his bedsit. He should never have been in his bedsit. He should have been in that prison to protect the public from him for the rest of his life. During a break, he taped a knife to each hand and fatally stabbed Cambridge graduates Jack Merritt, 25, and Saskia Jones, 23, before injuring three others. It is a tragedy that could have been avoided had Mr. Justice Wilkie's warning been heeded. And it's a tragedy that could have been avoided if people had listened to what nationalists had to say about the importing of Islam into Europe. This is something that nationalists have been speaking about, that have been warning about for decades. Nationalists were warning about this before we had had any terrorist attacks on European soil. We had been warning of the different cultures that these countries have, and the different things that they find acceptable, which we don't find acceptable over here. We don't find it acceptable to be marrying 9-year-old girls. We don't find female genital mutilation to be acceptable. We don't think it is acceptable to flog people and stone women for adultery. And we don't think it is acceptable to murder people for drawing pictures of Muhammad. All of these things are cultural differences that really cannot be overcome. And if we're going to invite these people into our country and tell them that we celebrate multiculturalism, how can we then criticize them when they bring their culture with them? It's not joined up thinking. This is why people have this cognitive dissonance all the time, is because we're being told one thing while at the same time we're being told The opposite. We're being told multiculturalism is brilliant and we should be celebrating it. And yet when these people bring their culture over here, we end up saying, well, that's wrong and that's against the law. But they're not interested in obeying our laws. An extremist Muslim sees Sharia law as being the real law that he needs to be obeying. And Islam teaches them that they should be obeying Sharia law. So really, it should only be common sense that if we have a people that wish to observe a different law system to us, that we should try to keep them out from our countries, because otherwise they will seek to establish that law system within our country, and they will obey that law system instead of our own. The inquest, which ended yesterday, has heard how Khan played the system as soon as he started his prison term. The British-born son of Pakistani immigrants wrote to the Home Office from his cell at Belmarsh, begging to join a de-radicalisation scheme to prove that he no longer harboured extremist views or posed a threat. Insisting that his conviction stemmed from immaturity, he wrote, "Now I am much more mature and want to live my life as a good Muslim and also a good citizen of Britain." But this is just it, isn't it? A good Muslim, according to Islam, is somebody who dies for Islam. And we see, a lot of the time, we see when these extremist Muslims are killed, we see a lot of other Muslims that turn up for the funeral. I'm thinking in particular of this refugee that stabbed people in Glasgow earlier last year, and at his funeral, lots of Muslims turned up. At the funeral for the Chechen that beheaded Samuel Paty in France, in Chechnya, at his funeral, he had the funeral of a state dignitary. I mean, it was incredible to see. This guy had just beheaded a teacher in France, and he was, at his funeral, he was treated like he was a national hero in Chechnya. So at least they've accepted that he was playing the system here. But any of them that are claiming that they now want to be a good Muslim, you have to be suspicious, because their idea of a good Muslim is completely different to the government's idea of a good Muslim. Using legal aid, Khan appealed his original sentence, and in 2013, three appeal court judges, led by Sir Brian Leveson, concluded it was wrong for Mr. Justice Wilkie to have handed Khan a tougher sentence than some of the others in the terror cell. And how many times have we heard about these appeal court judges that come down on the side of the false refugees that the government are trying to deport, and the appeal court comes down on the side of them? Well, here we have the appeal court coming down on the side of the terrorists, saying that he shouldn't have been given such a long sentence, and because of that, he's allowed out, and he kills two people. So Brian scrapped Khan's indeterminate sentence, handing him a 16-year jail term instead, meaning he would be automatically released after 8 years. He had already served three of these, so was due out after just five more. Imagine that. He's been sent to prison for the rest of his life by one judge to protect the public from him, and now, because of this other judge, this Sir Brian Leveson, he's going to be out of prison just within 5 years. Khan's behaviour in jail, however, was at complete odds with his pretense to officials that he was a reformed character. Throughout his 8 years inside, he tried to radicalise, bully and forcibly convert other prisoners. The jihadi became a Muslim enforcer and ordered a string of violent attacks on non-Muslim inmates and staff. So how could this judge, how could this Sir Brian Leveson, how could he not have known that this was going on? Surely there must have been reports compiled on this Khan that would have been presented to this judge. But apparently either the judge didn't take any notice of them, or these reports didn't actually get to him. He was recorded in Belmarsh saying he wants to come from behind someone and do him in the neck, and that he wanted to die and go to paradise. Around the same time he was pleading his innocence to the Home Office, Khan leapt onto security netting in prison and shouted, "Cut off the kafir's head." How can this not have reached this Brian Leveson? because they know this now. They're pointing this out now. They're pointing out that he did these things and he was doing these things in prison, so there must have been a record of it. So how come that record didn't get to Sir Brian Leveson? On another night of concerted indiscipline, he almost broke through to the cell of a neighbouring inmate and was found with the prison governor's home address. I mean, why would you have the prison governor's home address? So obviously, because he was up to no good. At Belmarsh, he asked to be placed in segregation so that he could be close to notorious hate preacher Abu Hamza, who is now in a US prison for plotting to set up a terrorist training camp. In March 2017, he was heard discussing Islam through his cell window with Michael Adebolajo, who is serving a full life term for murdering Fusilier Lee Rigby in 2013. So that's as late as 2017 that he was associating with other extremist Muslims that had murdered British citizens. And it was just 2 years later that he was allowed out of the prison into this fishmonger's hall, where he attacked the two people that had been trying to help him. Prison officers also discovered that he was hoarding a prescription medicine which can be used as a component in improvised explosive devices. And they also found him with a concealed razor blade. I mean, it couldn't get more obvious, could it, that this guy has ulterior motives on his mind, that he has evil on his mind, and yet he was still allowed out, and the judge still commuted his sentence so that he could be allowed out. Jail bosses were so concerned about his behaviour that they moved him 9 times between 7 different prisons. Throughout his sentence, Khan was graded as a high-risk prisoner whose escape would be highly dangerous. There are fewer than 100 such inmates in the entire British prison population of more than 80,000 at any one time. And I wonder whether it was his human rights that prevented this information from being given to the judge, because it seems as if this information wasn't given to the people doing the rehabilitating either. I bet it was something to do with the human rights, that it would be against his human rights, as it might prejudice the people trying to rehabilitate him if they were to be told of all the incidences of where he was planning to do evil things while he was actually there in prison. In all, his extremist behaviour in jail had generated more than 40 reports spanning 2,000 pages. I mean, it's just inconceivable that this judge had not seen any of those reports. As his release date approached, he claimed he had mended his ways, but intelligence reports suggested otherwise. They found he was using takia, a permissible form of telling lies to advance Islam, and he was using this during de-radicalization sessions to play the system. Now, takia is understood as being just that. It's a permissible form within Islam of telling lies. And so the government are saying they understand this. They understand that Muslims are told that they can use lies if it's going to advance Islam. And yet we still accept what they say. We still accept them as witnesses. We still think that they're going to be telling us the truth when they're in the dock in court. And yet it's a part of their system that they can tell lies. They are permitted to tell lies to advance what their idea of Islam is. And this is a part of mainstream Islam. It's not just a part of the extremist side of it. Officials concluded that he was deceptively compliant so that he could creep below the radar of counter-terrorism officers. So how did he creep below the radar? How could he have crept below the radar if the officials had concluded that that was what he was doing? In a risk guidance report, a psychologist warned that Khan had made little progress in prison and that his risk to society was potentially worse than before he was jailed. So he's been radicalised all the more while he was in prison, probably from seeing Abu Hamza and Michael Adebolajo. Yeva Chekavikiuti told the inquest, "Knowing the content of my assessment, I was very worried. I summarised quite bluntly my assessment of his risk." The experienced prison psychologist said she noticed an underlying anger and bitterness in him and was quite certain that he was trying to trick those who were assessing him. This damning verdict was backed up by an intelligence report which recorded Khan as saying he would return to his old ways when he was freed. I mean, this is just unbelievable, isn't it, that they could know all of this and yet they still allowed him out. You know, we have nationalists that are in prison under terrorist laws, and they're not allowed out. They've been told that because of this, they're not going to be allowed out after half their sentence has been finished, because this extremist Muslim tried to go out and kill somebody. We have people, nationalists, that are in prison that have been accused of terrorism offences that are not there for planning terrorist attacks, but for being a member of a terrorist organisation, and they're not going to be allowed out. And yet we have somebody here that is shown to be a risk to society, that was plotting violence, and despite all these reports, despite these 40 different reports that were made on him, he was still allowed out. He was classified as a very high risk to the public and as having shown no substantive progress. Yet despite these grave concerns, he was released on Christmas Eve 2018 because he had served half his sentence. Under the terms of his 22 license conditions, Khan was required to wear an electronic tag, banned from using the internet without supervision, and subjected to a curfew, and his movements around the country were severely restricted. Yet, despite all these reports, he was still allowed out of prison. They still ignored what that first judge had said, and instead they did what this Sir Brian Leveson has said. I mean, it's this Sir Brian Leveson that needs to be investigated, I think. He's the one that is at fault here for allowing this appeal and allowing him out. He was also assigned a specialist anti-extremist parole officer, as well as being monitored by police and MI5. Immediately, Khan set about trying to convince them all that he was a reformed man. PC Victoria Barker, part of Staffordshire Police's de-radicalisation team, found him friendly and never thought in a million years he would launch an attack. Well, how gullible is she? Does she not know about this takia that Muslims use? Does she not understand anything about extremist Islam? I mean, how could she never think in a million years that this man is likely to launch an attack? I mean, common sense tells you that he's going to be a risk for the rest of his life. Throughout 2019, Khan ensured he complied with all his license conditions, and he ingratiated himself with Learning Together, a prisoner rehabilitation workshop. And I wonder how liberal this Learning Together workshop were. I wonder if they were promoting equality and gender equality and LGBTQ+ and all of that to him. Because if they are promoting that to a Muslim and the Muslim pretends to be going along with it, it's quite obvious that they are just pretending to go along with it, because Islam is against all of that. Just all of Islam is against all of that, not just the extremist type. He expressed a desire to work with police and Muslim youths to stop them from becoming radicalized. Prison chiefs, probation staff, criminologists, and even some police officers believed him. Why did they ignore these reports? Why did they ignore the reports by the experts? It must be that they didn't get a chance to see them. William Stiles, now a deputy director at the prison service, is alleged to have said in June 2019, Usman is a good man and has completely reformed. Mr. Stiles denies using the word completely. Just 3 days before he carried out his attack, Khan told Employment Centre manager Julia Nix, I am 100% sure that I don't have any terrorist thoughts at all. I mean, he must have struggled to keep a straight face when he was telling her that one, I'm sure. The following day, probation officer Ken Skelton described Khan as low risk, the first time he had been moved off high risk since his arrest 9 years earlier. In a 14-page report, Mr. Skelton wrote that Khan's likelihood of reoffending is low and the risk of extremism is low. That prevailing view meant that Khan was allowed to travel without a police escort to central London for the first time since his release and commit the atrocity. During the inquest, Jonathan Hoff, QC, told Mr. Skelton, "You place a lot of reliance not only on Usman Khan's compliance, but on him being honest with you. He had been constantly dishonest about his previous offending." Asked if he honestly thought it was safe for Khan to travel to London, Mr. Skelton replied, "I was not getting intelligence or information from the police that would suggest otherwise. But it has since emerged that there was evidence that the extremist intended to carry out an attack." The deputy director of MI5 admitted that it had intelligence that Khan wanted to die and go to paradise. The agency had been passed two key pieces of intelligence suggesting that Khan wanted to return to his old ways and had planned to carry out an attack. But both pieces of information were uncorroborated and of unknown validity, and they were not shared with the other agencies who were monitoring him. Had this happened, the probation service and others might not have taken such a rosy view of Khan. Well, why was this information not shared? Why have we not been given the reason for why that is? I bet it does have something to do with human rights. The relatives of the two unfortunate people that were murdered, they gave a speech at the end of this inquiry the other day. I caught some of it on the BBC News, and they were saying that the two people concerned had not been given this information. They had not been told about these 40 reports that were compiled on him in prison. You know, they thought that he was a really good man and that he had turned over a new leaf. And if they had been told the truth, they may still be alive today. I mean, it may be that they really wanted to believe in the goodness of this man. They projected their own qualities, their own spiritual qualities, they projected them onto this man. And you can see that from learning about them. And you can learn this about the male one. I think it was the male one that believed that everybody could change. And I think the female one, I think she was more interested in criminology and helping the victims of crime rather than actually helping the criminals. I think it was her relative that was particularly angry about this, and that they hadn't been given the full information about this. I mean, once again, white people's gullibility has been taken advantage of here. The fact that we wish to believe the best in everyone, the fact that we know that we are capable of turning over a new leaf, we project that onto others, other people for whom there is no evidence that they're capable of turning over a new leaf. I mean, the judge at the beginning of this, he said that this Khan should stay in prison for the rest of his life. And yet somewhere along the way, another judge decided he was going to overturn that and that Khan was capable of turning over a new leaf. And there was no evidence to show that. The evidence was showing that he was still a radical, he was still a jihadi, and yet this Brian Leveson, he overturned this. That's who should be investigated here. That's who the relatives of the deceased, that's who they need to be investigating and trying to find out why he allowed this to happen. Because it was allowed to happen by the authorities. Our drive to be charitable and to have mercy on people, it works very well when it's directed just against our own people. But when it is directed against people from other races, it just means that we are being put in a position where we can be taken advantage of. And that is what unfortunately happened to these two white people. They projected their wish to be merciful and charitable, they projected it on one of our competitors. And this competitor decided that he was going to take advantage of that and he was going to murder them. And this is the other lesson that needs to be taken from this. Our drive to be merciful and charitable, that has to only be directed towards our own people. If it's directed to others, we're just putting ourselves at risk. I mean, even if it's with smaller things, It means that we are putting ourselves at risk, and the people that have been given that charity and that mercy, they're just going to think, well, look how gullible these white people are. We can take advantage of them, and they just let us off when we commit these crimes. As far as Islamic radicals are concerned, the very fact is that because of this takia, you can never know whether they are going to change their mind over something. So that means that you can never let them out of prison. And if you have them in prison all the time, it means you're running the risk of them radicalizing others within that prison. So the best thing to do is to deport them to another country. You could deport them to Pakistan, you could deport them to Saudi Arabia, just deport them to one of these Islamic countries that has Sharia law, where they want to be. And that means that you're not going to be running the risk of radicalizing all the other prisoners, because the other prisoners that are going to be there are going to be radicalized anyway. They're going to be followers of Sharia law. And that is the most sensible thing to do with these Islamic terrorists, is to do a deal with one of these other Islamic countries and deport them there. And their families can go with them. You could offer the families money to go over there as well. And then you would know for certain that that's one group of people that are not going to be able to carry out terrorist attacks in the country. That would be actually keeping the British people safe, and it wouldn't be going against their human rights, because you wouldn't be just deporting the whole family. You would be offering them some kind of financial incentive to go, so they would be leaving voluntarily, and you would have one less jihadi to worry about in the country. Apparently there are thousands that are on the watch lists, and how many of them have we got within prison? And the fact that they are unlikely to change their terrorist views means that that gets projected onto the whites that are in prison on terrorist charges, as I pointed out, mainly for being members of a terrorist organization. And now they aren't going to be allowed out after half of their sentence. It's very unjust to look at them in the same view as we look at Islamic radicals. I mean, because there's a religious element to the Islamic extremists that is not there with the so-called far-right extremists. Anyway, this whole incident could have so easily been avoided, and I think it really is this judge, this Brian Leveson, that needs to be investigated, and why he allowed this appeal to be upheld, and why he ignored all these reports that showed that this Khan was still a threat to the country. And these reports were basically showing the reasons for why he should be kept in prison for the rest of his life, which is what that first judge wanted. Well, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.